By the help of his prime minister, Pietro della Vigna, he promulgated a new legal code, derived from Roman law and showing a high level of civilization in his southern dominion. The code was at once translated into Greek for the benefit of the Greek-speaking inhabitants. He founded an important university at Naples. He minted gold coins called augustals, the first gold coins in the West for many centuries. He established freer trade and abolished all internal customs. He even summoned elected representatives of the cities to his council, which, however, had only consultative powers. This period of peace ended when Frederick again came into conflict with the Lombard League in 1237. The Pope threw in his lot with them and again excommunicated the emperor. From this time until Frederick's death in 1250, the war was practically continuous, growing on both sides, gradually more bitter, cruel, and treacherous. There were great fluctuations of fortune, and the issue was still undecided when the emperor died. But those who attempted to be his successors had not his power and were gradually defeated, leaving Italy divided and the Pope victorious. Deaths of popes made little difference in the struggle. Each new pope took up his predecessor's policy practically unchanged. Gregory IX died in 1241. In 1243, Innocent IV, a bitter enemy of Frederick, was elected. Louis IX, in spite of his impeccable orthodoxy, tried to moderate the fury of Gregory and Innocent IV, but in vain. Innocent, especially, rejected all overtures from the emperor and used all manner of unscrupulous expedients against him. He pronounced him deposed, declared a crusade against him, and excommunicated all who supported him. The friars preached against him. The Muslims rose. There were plots among his prominent nominal supporters. All this made Frederick increasingly cruel. Plotters were ferociously punished, and prisoners were deprived of the right eye and the right hand. At one time, during this titanic struggle, Frederick thought of founding a new religion, in which he was to be the Messiah, and his minister, Pietro della Vigna, was to take the place of St. Peter. He did not get so far as to make this project public, but wrote about it to della Vigna. Suddenly, however, he became convinced, rightly or wrongly, that Pietro was plotting against him. He blinded him and exhibited him publicly in a cage. Pietro, however, avoided further suffering by suicide. Frederick, in spite of his abilities, could not have succeeded, because the antipapal forces that existed in his time were pious and democratic, whereas his aim was something like a restoration of the pagan Roman Empire. In culture, he was enlightened, but politically he was retrograde. His court was oriental. He had a harem with eunuchs. But it was in this court that Italian poetry began. He himself had some merit as a poet. In his conflict with the papacy, he published controversial statements as to the dangers of ecclesiastical absolutism, which would have been applauded in the 16th century, but fell flat in his own day. The heretics, who should have been his allies, appeared to him simply rebels, and to please the Pope he persecuted them. The free cities, but for the emperor, might have opposed the Pope, but so long as Frederick demanded their submission, they welcomed the Pope as an ally. Thus, although he was free from the superstitions of his age, and in culture far above other contemporary rulers, his position as emperor compelled him to oppose all that was politically liberal. He failed inevitably, but of all the failures in history, he remains one of the most interesting. The heretics, against whom Innocent III crusaded, and whom all rulers, including Frederick, persecuted, deserve study, both in themselves and as giving a glimpse of popular feeling, of which otherwise hardly a hint appears in the writings of the time. The most interesting, and also the largest, of the heretical sects were the Cathari, who in the south of France are better known as Albigenses. Their doctrines came from Asia by way of the Balkans. They were widely held in northern Italy, and in the south of France they were held by the great majority, including nobles, who liked the excuse to seize church lands. The cause of this wide diffusion of heresy was partly disappointment at the failure of the Crusades, but mainly moral disgust at the wealth and wickedness of the clergy. There was a widespread feeling, analogous to later Puritanism, in favor of personal holiness. This was associated with a cult of poverty. The church was rich and largely worldly. Very many priests were grossly immoral. The friars brought accusations against the older orders and the parish priests, asserting abuse of the confessional for purposes of seduction, and the enemies of the friars retorted the accusation. There can be no doubt that such charges were largely justified. The more the church claimed supremacy on religious grounds, the more plain people were shocked by the contrast between profession and performance. The same motives which ultimately led to the Reformation were operative in the 13th century. The main difference was that secular rulers were not ready to throw in their lot with the heretics, and this was largely because no existing philosophy could reconcile heresy with the claims of kings to dominion. The tenets of the Cathari cannot be known with certainty, as we are entirely dependent on the testimony of their enemies. Moreover, ecclesiastics, being well versed in the history of heresy, tended to apply some familiar label and to attribute to existing sects all the tenets of former ones, often on the basis of some not very close resemblance. Nevertheless, there is a good deal that is almost beyond question. It seems that the Cathari were dualists, and that, like the Gnostics, they considered the Old Testament Jehovah a wicked demiurge, the true God being only revealed in the New Testament. They regarded matter as essentially evil, and believed that for the virtuous there is no resurrection of the body. The wicked, however, will suffer transmigration into the bodies of animals. On this ground, they were vegetarians, abstaining even from eggs, cheese, and milk. They ate fish, however, because they believed that fishes are not sexually generated. All sex was abhorrent to them. Marriage, some said, is even worse than adultery, because it is continuous and complacent. On the other hand, they saw no objection to suicide. They accepted the New Testament more literally than did the Orthodox. They abstained from oaths and turned the other cheek. The persecutors record a case of a man accused of heresy who defended himself by saying that he ate meat, lied, swore, and was a good Catholic. The stricter precepts of the sect were only to be observed by certain exceptionally holy people called the perfected. The others might eat meat and even marry. It is interesting to trace the genealogy of these doctrines. They come to Italy and France by way of the Crusaders from a sect called the Bogomiles in Bulgaria. In 1167, when the Cathari held a council near Toulouse, Bulgarian delegates attended. The Bogomiles, in turn, were the result of a fusion of Manichaeans and Politians. The Politians were an Armenian sect who rejected infant baptism, purgatory, the invocation of saints, and the Trinity. They spread gradually into Thrace and thence into Bulgaria. The Politians were followers of Marcion, circa AD 150, who considered himself to be following St. Paul in rejecting the Jewish elements in Christianity, and who had some affinity with the Gnostics without being one of them. The only other popular heresy that I shall consider is that of the Waldenses. These were the followers of Peter Waldo, an enthusiast who, in 1170, started a crusade for observance of the law of Christ. He gave all his goods to the poor and founded a society called the Poor Men of Lyon, who practiced poverty and a strictly virtuous life. At first, they had papal approval, but they inveighed somewhat too forcibly against the immorality of the clergy and were condemned by the Council of Verona in 1184. Thereupon they decided that every good man is competent to preach and expound the scriptures. They appointed their own ministers and dispensed with the services of the Catholic priesthood. They spread to Lombardy and to Bohemia, where they paved the way for the Hussites. In the Albigensian persecution, which affected them also, many fled to Piedmont. It was their persecution in Piedmont in Milton's time that occasioned his sonnet, "Avenge, O Lord, thy slaughtered saints." They survive to this day in remote alpine valleys and in the United States. All this heresy alarmed the church, and vigorous measures were taken to suppress it. Innocent III considered that heretics deserved death, being guilty of treason to Christ. He called upon the King of France to embark upon a crusade against the Albigenses, which was done in 1209. It was conducted with incredible ferocity. After the taking of Carcassonne, especially, there was an appalling massacre. The ferreting out of heresy had been the business of the bishops, but it became too onerous to be performed by men who had other duties, and in 1233, Gregory IX founded the Inquisition to take over this part of the work of the episcopate. After 1254, those accused by the Inquisition were not allowed counsel. If condemned, their property was confiscated, in France, to the crown. When an accused person was found guilty, he was handed over to the secular arm with a prayer that his life might be spared. But if the secular authorities failed to burn him, they were liable to be themselves brought before the Inquisition. It dealt not only with heresy in the ordinary sense, but with sorcery and witchcraft. In Spain, it was mainly directed against crypto-Jews. Its work was performed mainly by Dominicans and Franciscans. It never penetrated Scandinavia or England, but the English were quite ready to make use of it against Joan of Arc. On the whole, it was very successful. At the outset, it completely stamped out the Albigensian heresy. The Church in the early 13th century was in danger of a revolt scarcely less formidable than that of the 16th. From this, it was saved, very largely, by the rise of the mendicant orders. St. Francis and St. Dominic did much more for orthodoxy than was done by even the most vigorous popes. St. Francis of Assisi, 1181 or 1182 to 1226, was one of the most lovable men known to history. He was of a well-to-do family, and in his youth was not averse to ordinary gaieties. But one day, as he was riding by a leper, a sudden impulse of pity led him to dismount and kiss the man. Soon afterwards, he decided to forgo all worldly goods and devote his life to preaching and good works. His father, a respectable businessman, was furious, but could not deter him. He soon gathered a band of followers, all vowed to complete poverty. At first, the church viewed the movement with some suspicion. It seemed too like the poor men of Lyon. The first missionaries whom St. Francis sent to distant places were taken for heretics, because they practiced poverty instead of, like the monks, only taking a vow which no one regarded as serious. But Innocent III was shrewd enough to see the value of the movement if it could be kept within the bounds of orthodoxy, and in 1209 or 1210 he gave recognition to the new order. Gregory IX, who was a personal friend of St. Francis, continued to favour him, while imposing certain rules which were irksome to the saint's enthusiastic and anarchic impulses. Francis wished to interpret the vow of poverty in the strictest possible way. He objected to houses or churches for his followers. They were to beg their bread, and to have no lodging but what chance hospitality provided. In 1219 he travelled to the east, and preached before the Sultan, who received him courteously but remained a Mohammedan. On his return he found that the Franciscans had built themselves a house. He was deeply pained, but the Pope induced or compelled him to give way. After his death, Gregory canonized him, but softened his rule in the article of poverty. In the matter of saintliness, Francis has had equals. What makes him unique among saints is his spontaneous happiness, his universal love, and his gifts as a poet. His goodness appears always devoid of effort, as though it had no dross to overcome. He loved all living things, not only as a Christian or a benevolent man, but as a poet. His hymn to the sun, written shortly before his death, might almost have been written by Akhenaten, the sun-worshipper, but not quite. Christianity informs it, though not very obviously. He felt a duty to lepers for their sake, not for his. Unlike most Christian saints, he was more interested in the happiness of others than in his own salvation. He never showed any feeling of superiority, even to the humblest or most wicked. Thomas of Celano said of him that he was more than a saint among saints. Among sinners, he was one of themselves. If Satan existed, the future of the order founded by St. Francis would afford him the most exquisite gratification. The saint's immediate successor, as head of the order, Brother Elias, wallowed in luxury and allowed a complete abandonment of poverty. The chief work of the Franciscans in the years immediately following the death of their founder was as recruiting sergeants in the bitter and bloody wars of Guelphs and Ghibellines. The Inquisition, founded 7 years after his death, was in several countries chiefly conducted by Franciscans. A small minority, called the Spirituals, remained true to his teaching. Many of these were burnt by the Inquisition for heresy. These men held that Christ and the apostles owned no property, not even the clothes they wore. This opinion was condemned as heretical in 1323 by John XXII. The net result of St. Francis's life was to create yet one more wealthy and corrupt order, to strengthen the hierarchy, and to facilitate the persecution of all who excelled in moral earnestness or freedom of thought. In view of his own aims and character, it is impossible to imagine any more bitterly ironical outcome. St. Dominic, 1170 to 1221, is much less interesting than St. Francis. He was a Castilian and had, like Loyola, a fanatical devotion to orthodoxy. His main purpose was to combat heresy, and he adopted poverty as a means to this end. He was present throughout the Albigensian War, though he is said to have deplored some of its more extreme atrocities. The Dominican Order was founded in 1215 by Innocent III and won quick success. The only human trait known to me in St. Dominic is his confession to Jordan of Saxony that he liked talking to young women better than to old ones. In 1242, the order solemnly decreed that this passage should be deleted from Jordan's life of the founder. The Dominicans were even more active than the Franciscans in the work of the Inquisition. They performed, however, a valuable service to mankind by their devotion to learning. This was no part of St. Dominic's intention. He had decreed that his friars were not to learn secular sciences or liberal arts except by dispensation. This rule was abrogated in 1259, after which date everything was done to make a studious life easy for Dominicans. Manual labor was no part of their duties, and the hours of devotion were shortened to give them more time for study. They devoted themselves to reconciling Aristotle and Christ. Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas, both Dominicans, accomplished this task as well as it is capable of being accomplished. The authority of Thomas Aquinas was so overwhelming that subsequent Dominicans did not achieve much in philosophy. Though Francis, even more than Dominic, had disliked learning, the greatest names in the immediately following period are Franciscan. Roger Bacon, Duns Scotus, and William of Ockham were all Franciscans. What the friars accomplished for philosophy will be the subject of the following chapters. Chapter 13. St. Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, born 1225 or 1226, died 1274, is regarded as the greatest of scholastic philosophers. In all Catholic educational institutions that teach philosophy, his system has to be taught as the only right one. This has been the rule since a rescript of 1879 by Leo XIII. St. Thomas, therefore, is not only of historical interest, but is a living influence, like Plato, Aristotle, Kant, and Hegel, more, in fact, than the latter two. In most respects, he follows Aristotle so closely that the Stagirite has, among Catholics, almost the authority of one of the fathers. To criticize him in matters of pure philosophy has come to be thought almost impious. Footnote. When I did so in a broadcast, very many protests from Catholics resulted. End of footnote. This was not always the case. In the time of Aquinas, the battle for Aristotle as against Plato still had to be fought. The influence of Aquinas secured the victory until the Renaissance. Then Plato, who became better known than in the Middle Ages, again acquired supremacy in the opinion of most philosophers. In the 17th century, it was possible to be orthodox and a Cartesian. Malebranche, though a priest, was never censured. But in our day, such freedoms are a thing of the past. Catholic ecclesiastics must accept St. Thomas if they concern themselves with philosophy. St. Thomas was the son of the Count of Aquino, whose castle in the Kingdom of Naples was close to Monte Cassino, where the education of the angelic doctor began. He was for 6 years at Frederick II's University of Naples. Then he became a Dominican and went to Cologne to study under Albertus Magnus, who was the leading Aristotelian among the philosophers of the time. After a period in Cologne and Paris, he returned to Italy in 1259, where he spent the rest of his life except for the 3 years, 1269 to 72. During these 3 years, he was in Paris, where the Dominicans, on account of their Aristotelianism, were in trouble with the university authorities and were suspected of heretical sympathy with the Averroists, who had a powerful party in the university. The Averroists held, on the basis of their interpretation of Aristotle, that the soul, insofar as it is individual, is not immortal. Immortality belongs only to the intellect, which is impersonal and identical in different intellectual beings. When it was forcibly brought to their notice that this doctrine is contrary to the Catholic faith, they took refuge in the subterfuge of double truth. One sort, based on reason, in philosophy, and another, based on revelation, in theology. All this brought Aristotle into bad odour, and St. Thomas, in Paris, was concerned to undo the harm done by too close adherence to Arabian doctrines. In this he was singularly successful. Aquinas, unlike his predecessors, had a really competent knowledge of Aristotle. His friend, William of Merbeke, provided him with translations from the Greek, and he himself wrote commentaries. Until his time, men's notions of Aristotle had been obscured by Neoplatonic accretions. He, however, followed the genuine Aristotle and disliked Platonism, even as it appears in St. Augustine. He succeeded in persuading the Church that Aristotle's system was to be preferred to Plato's as the basis of Christian philosophy, and that Mohammedans and Christian Averroists had misinterpreted Aristotle. For my part, I should say that the De Anima leads much more naturally to the view of Averroes than to that of Aquinas. However, the Church, since St. Thomas, has thought otherwise. I should say further that Aristotle's views on most questions of logic and philosophy were not final, and have since been proved to be largely erroneous. This opinion also is not allowed to be professed by any Catholic philosopher or teacher of philosophy. St. Thomas's most important work, the Summa Contra Gentilis, was written during the years 1259-64. It is concerned to establish the truth of the Christian religion by arguments addressed to a reader supposed to be not already a Christian. One gathers that the imaginary reader is usually thought of as a man versed in the philosophy of the Arabs. He wrote another book, Summa Theologiae, of almost equal importance, but of somewhat less interest to us because less designed to use arguments not assuming in advance the truth of Christianity. What follows is an abstract of the Summa Contra Gentilis. Let us first consider what is meant by wisdom. A man may be wise in some particular pursuit, such as making houses. This implies that he knows the means to some particular end. But all particular ends are subordinate to the end of the universe, and wisdom per se is concerned with the end of the universe. Now, the end of the universe is the good of the intellect, that is, truth. The pursuit of wisdom in this sense is the most perfect, sublime, profitable, and delightful of pursuits. All this is proved by appeal to the authority of the philosopher, that is, Aristotle. My purpose, he says, is to declare the truth which the Catholic faith professes. But here I must have recourse to natural reason, since the Gentiles do not accept the authority of Scripture. Natural reason, however, is deficient in the things of God. It can prove some parts of the faith, but not others. It can prove the existence of God and the immortality of the soul, but not the Trinity, the Incarnation, or the Last Judgment. Whatever is demonstrable is, so far as it goes, in accordance with the Christian faith, and nothing in Revelation is contrary to reason. But it is important to separate the parts of the faith which can be proved by reason from those which cannot. Accordingly, of the four books into which the Summa is divided, the first three make no appeal to revelation, except to show that it is in accordance with conclusions reached by reason. Only in the fourth book are matters treated which cannot be known apart from revelation. The first step is to prove the existence of God. Some think this unnecessary, since the existence of God, they say, is self-evident. If we knew God's essence, this would be true, since, as is proved later, in God, essence and existence are one. But we do not know his essence, except very imperfectly. Wise men know more of his essence than do the ignorant, and angels know more than either. But no creature knows enough of it to be able to deduce God's existence from his essence. On this ground, the ontological argument is rejected. It is important to remember that religious truth, which can be proved, can also be known by faith. The proofs are difficult and can only be understood by the learned. But faith is necessary also to the ignorant, to the young, and to those who, from practical preoccupations, have not the leisure to learn philosophy. For them, revelation suffices. Some say that God is only knowable by faith. They argue that if the principles of demonstration became known to us through experience derived from the senses, as is said in the Posterior Analytics, whatever transcends sense cannot be proved. This, however, is false. And even if it were true, God could be known from his sensible effects. The existence of God is proved, as in Aristotle, by the argument of the unmoved mover. Footnote. but in Aristotle the argument leads to 47 or 55 gods. End of footnote. There are things which are only moved, and other things which both move and are moved. Whatever is moved by something, and since an endless regress is impossible, we must arrive somewhere at something which moves without being moved. This unmoved mover is God. It might be objected that this argument involves the eternity of movement, which Catholics reject. This would be an error. It is valid on the hypothesis of the eternity of movement, but is only strengthened by the opposite hypothesis, which involves a beginning, and therefore a first cause. In the Summa Theologiae, five proofs of God's existence are given. First, the argument of the unmoved mover, as above. Second, the argument of the first cause, which again depends upon the impossibility of an infinite regress. Third, that there must be an ultimate source of all necessity. This is much the same as the second argument. Fourth, that we find various perfections in the world, and that these must have their source in something completely perfect. Fifth, that we find even lifeless things serving a purpose, which must be that of some being outside them, since only living things can have an internal purpose. To return to the Summa Contra Gentilis. Having proved the existence of God, we can now say many things about him, but these are all in a sense negative. God's nature is only known to us through what it is not. God is eternal, since he is unmoved. He is unchanging, since he contains no passive potentiality. David of Dinant, a materialist pantheist of the early 13th century, raved that God is the same as primary matter. This is absurd, since primary matter is pure passivity, and God is pure activity. In God, there is no composition, therefore he is not a body, because bodies have parts. God is his own essence, since otherwise he would not be simple, but would be compounded of essence and existence. This point is important. In God, essence and existence are identical. There are no accidents in God. He cannot be specified by any substantial difference. He is not any genus. He cannot be defined, but he lacks not the excellence of any genus. Things are in some ways like God, in others not. It is more fitting to say that things are like God than that God is like things. God is good and is his own goodness. He is the good of every good. He is intelligent, and his act of intelligence is his essence. He understands by his essence and understands himself perfectly. John the Scot, it will be remembered, thought otherwise. Although there is no composition in the divine intellect, God understands many things. This might seem a difficulty, but the things that he understands have no distinct being in him, nor do they exist per se, as Plato thought, because forms of natural things cannot exist or be understood apart from matter. Nevertheless, God must understand forms before creating. The solution of this difficulty is as follows. The concept of the divine intellect, according as he understands himself, which concept is his word, is the likeness not only of God himself understood, but also of all the things of which the divine essence is the likeness. Accordingly, many things can be understood by God, by one intelligible species, which is the divine essence, and by one understood intention, which is the divine word. Every form, so far as it is something positive, is a perfection. God's intellect includes in his essence what is proper to each thing, by understanding where it is like him and where unlike. For instance, life, not knowledge, is the essence of a plant, and knowledge, not intellect, is the essence of an animal. Thus, a plant is like God in being alive, but unlike in not having knowledge. An animal is like God in having knowledge, but unlike in not having intellect. It is always by a negation that a creature differs from God. God understands all things at the same instant. His knowledge is not a habit and is not discursive or argumentative. God is truth. This is to be understood literally. We come now to a question which had already troubled both Plato and Aristotle. Can God know particular things, or does he only know universals and general truths? A Christian, since he believes in providence, must hold that God knows particular things. Nevertheless, there are weighty arguments against this view. St. Thomas enumerates 7 such arguments and then proceeds to refute them. The 7 arguments are as follows. 1. Singularity being signate matter, nothing immaterial can know it. 2. Singulars do not always exist and cannot be known when they do not exist. Therefore, they cannot be known by an unchanging being. 3. Singulars are contingent, not necessary. Therefore, there can be no certain knowledge of them except when they exist. 4. Some singulars are due to volitions, which can only be known to the person willing. 5. Singulars are infinite in number, and the infinite as such is unknown. 6. Singulars are too petty for God's attention. 7. In some singulars there is evil, but God cannot know evil. Aquinas replies that God knows singulars as their cause, that he knows things that do not yet exist, just as an artificer does when he is making something, that he knows future contingents because he sees each thing in time as if present, he himself being not in time, that he knows our minds and secret wills, and that he knows an infinity of things, although we cannot do so. He knows trivial things because nothing is wholly trivial, and everything has some nobility. Otherwise, God would know only himself. Moreover, the order of the universe is very noble, and this cannot be known without knowing even the trivial parts. Finally, God knows evil things because knowing anything good involves knowing the opposite evil. In God, there is will. His will is his essence, and its principal object is the divine essence. In willing himself, God wills other things also, for God is the end of all things. He wills even things that are not yet. He wills his own being and goodness, but other things, though he wills them, he does not will necessarily. There is free will in God. A reason can be assigned for his volition, but not a cause. He cannot will things impossible in themselves. For example, he cannot make a contradiction true. The saint's example of something beyond even divine power is not an altogether happy one. He says that God could not make a man be an ass. In God are delight and joy and love. God hates nothing and possesses the contemplative and active virtues. He is happy and is his own happiness. We come now, in Book 2, to the consideration of creatures. This is useful for refuting errors against God. God created the world out of nothing, contrary to the opinions of the ancients. The subject of the things that God cannot do is resumed. He cannot be a body or change himself. He cannot fail. He cannot be weary or forget or repent or be angry or sad. He cannot make a man have no soul or make the sum of the angles of a triangle be not 2 right angles. He cannot undo the past, commit sins, make another God, or make himself not exist. Book 2 is mainly occupied with the soul in man. All intellectual substances are immaterial and incorruptible. Angels have no bodies, but in men the soul is united to a body. It is the form of the body, as in Aristotle. There are not 3 souls in man, but only 1. The whole soul is present entire in every part of the body. The souls of animals, unlike those of men, are not immortal. The intellect is part of each man's soul. There is not, as Averroes maintained, only 1 intellect in which various men participate. The soul is not transmitted with a semen, but is created afresh with each man. There is, it is true, a difficulty. When a man is born out of wedlock, this seems to make God an accomplice in adultery. This objection, however, is only specious. There is a grave objection which troubles St. Augustine, and that is as to the transmission of original sin. It is the soul that sins, and if the soul is not transmitted but created afresh, how can it inherit the sin of Adam? This is not discussed. In connection with the intellect, the problem of universals is discussed. St. Thomas's position is that of Aristotle. Universals do not subsist outside the soul, but the intellect, in understanding universals, understands things that are outside the soul. The third book is largely concerned with ethical questions. Evil is unintentional, not an essence, and has an accidental cause which is good. All things tend to be like God, who is the end of all things. Human happiness does not consist in carnal pleasures, honour, glory, wealth, worldly power, or goods of the body, and is not seated in the senses. Man's ultimate happiness does not consist in acts of moral virtue, because these are means. It consists in the contemplation of God. But the knowledge of God, possessed by the majority, does not suffice, nor the knowledge of him obtained by demonstration, nor even the knowledge obtained by faith. In this life, we cannot see God in his essence, or have ultimate happiness, but hereafter we shall see him face to face. Not literally, we are warned, because God has no face. This will happen not by our natural power, but by the divine light. And even then, we shall not see all of him. By this vision, we become partakers of eternal life, that is, of life outside time. Divine providence does not exclude evil, contingency, free will, chance, or luck. Evil comes through second causes, as in the case of a good artist with bad tools. Angels are not all equals. There is an order among them. Each angel is the sole specimen of his species, for since angels have no bodies, they can only be distinct through specific differences, not through position in space. Astrology is to be rejected for the usual reasons. In answer to the question, is there such a thing as fate, Aquinas replies that we might give the name fate to the order impressed by providence, but it is wiser not to do so, as fate is a pagan word. This leads to an argument that prayer is useful, although providence is unchangeable. I have failed to follow this argument. God sometimes works miracles, but no one else can. Magic, however, is possible with the help of demons. This is not properly miraculous, and is not by the help of the stars. Divine law directs us to love God. Also, in a lesser degree, our neighbor. It forbids fornication, because the father should stay with the mother while the children are being reared. It forbids birth control, as being against nature. It does not, however, on this account, forbid lifelong celibacy. Matrimony should be indissoluble, because the father is needed in the education of the children, both as more rational than the mother, and as having more physical strength when punishment is required. Not all carnal intercourse is sinful, since it is natural. But to think the married state as good as continence is to fall into the heresy of Jovinian. There must be strict monogamy. Polygyny is unfair to women, and polyandry makes paternity uncertain. Incest is to be forbidden because it would complicate family life. Against brother-sister incest, there is a very curious argument that if the love of husband and wife were combined with that of brother and sister, mutual attraction would be so strong as to cause unduly frequent intercourse. All these arguments on sexual ethics, it is to be observed, appeal to purely rational considerations, not to divine commands and prohibitions. Here, as throughout the first three books, Aquinas is glad, at the end of a piece of reasoning, to quote texts, showing that reason has led him to a conclusion in harmony with the scriptures, but he does not appeal to authority until his result has been reached. There is a most lively and interesting discussion of voluntary poverty, which, as one might expect, arrives ultimately at a conclusion in harmony with the principles of the mendicant orders, but states the objections with a force and realism which shows them to be such as he had actually heard urged by the secular clergy. He then passes on to sin, predestination, and election, on which his view is broadly that of Augustine. By mortal sin, a man forfeits his last end to all eternity, and therefore eternal punishment is his due. No man can be freed from sin except by grace, and yet the sinner is to be blamed if he is not converted. Man needs grace to persevere in good, but no one can merit divine assistance. God is not the cause of sinning, but some he leaves in sin, while others he delivers from it. As regards predestination, St. Thomas seems to hold, with St. Augustine, that no reason can be given why some are elected and go to heaven, while others are left reprobate and go to hell. He holds also that no man can enter heaven unless he has been baptized. This is not one of the truths that can be proved by the unaided reason. It is revealed in John chapter 3, verse 5. Footnote. Jesus answered, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God." End of footnote. The fourth book is concerned with the Trinity, the Incarnation, the supremacy of the Pope, the sacraments, and the resurrection of the body. In the main, it is addressed to theologians rather than philosophers, and I shall therefore deal with it only briefly. There are three ways of knowing God: by reason, by revelation, and by intuition of things previously known only by revelation. Of the third way, however, he says almost nothing. A writer inclined to mysticism would have said more of it than of either of the others. But Aquinas's temperament is ratiocinative rather than mystical. The Greek Church is blamed for denying the double procession of the Holy Ghost and the supremacy of the Pope. We are warned that, although Christ was conceived of the Holy Ghost, we must not suppose that he was the Son of the Holy Ghost according to the flesh. The sacraments are valid, even when dispensed by wicked ministers. This was an important point in church doctrine. Very many priests lived in mortal sin, and pious people feared that such priests could not administer the sacraments. This was awkward. No one could know if he was really married or if he had received valid absolution. It led to heresy and schism, since the puritanically minded sought to establish a separate priesthood of more impeccable virtue. The Church, in consequence, was obliged to assert with great emphasis that sin in a priest did not incapacitate him for the performance of his functions. One of the last questions discussed is the resurrection of the body. Here, as elsewhere, Aquinas states very fairly the arguments that have been brought against orthodox position. One of these, at first sight, offers great difficulties. What is to happen, asks the saint, to a man who never throughout his life ate anything but human flesh, and whose parents did likewise? It would seem unfair to his victims that they should be deprived of their bodies at the last day as a consequence of his greed. Yet, if not, what will be left to make up his body? I am happy to say that this difficulty, which might at first sight seem insuperable, is triumphantly met. The identity of the body, St. Thomas points out, is not dependent on the persistence of the same material particles. During life, by the processes of eating and digesting, the matter composing the body undergoes perpetual change. The cannibal may, therefore, receive the same body at the resurrection, even if it is not composed of the same matter as was in his body when he died. With this comforting thought, we may end our abstract of the Summa Contra Gentilis. In its general outlines, the philosophy of Aquinas agrees with that of Aristotle, and will be accepted or rejected by a reader in the measure in which he accepts or rejects the philosophy of the Stagirite. The originality of Aquinas is shown in his adaptation of Aristotle to Christian dogma, with a minimum of alteration. In his day, he was considered a bold innovator. Even after his death, many of his doctrines were condemned by the universities of Paris and Oxford. He was even more remarkable for systematizing than for originality. Even if every one of his doctrines were mistaken, the Summa would remain an imposing intellectual edifice. When he wishes to refute some doctrine, he states it first, often with great force, and almost always with an attempt at fairness. The sharpness and clarity with which he distinguishes arguments derived from reason and arguments derived from revelation are admirable. He knows Aristotle well and understands him thoroughly, which cannot be said of any earlier Catholic philosopher. These merits, however, seem scarcely sufficient to justify his immense reputation. The appeal to reason is, in a sense, insincere, since the conclusion to be reached is fixed in advance. Take, for example, the indissolubility of marriage. This is advocated on the ground that the father is useful in the education of the children, A, because he is more rational than the mother, B, because being stronger, he is better able to inflict physical punishment. A modern educator might retort, A, that there is no reason to suppose men in general more rational than women, B, that the sort of punishment that requires great physical strength is not desirable in education. He might go on to point out that fathers in the modern world have scarcely any part in education. But no follower of St. Thomas would, on that account, cease to believe in lifelong monogamy because the real grounds of belief are not those which are alleged. Or take again the arguments professing to prove the existence of God. All of these, except the one from teleology and lifeless things, depend upon the supposed impossibility of a series having no first term. Every mathematician knows that there is no such impossibility. The series of negative integers ending with minus one is an instance to the contrary. But here again, no Catholic is likely to abandon belief in God, even if he becomes convinced that St. Thomas's arguments are bad. He will invent other arguments, or take refuge in revelation. The contentions that God's essence and existence are one and the same, that God is his own goodness, his own power, and so on, suggest a confusion, found in Plato, but supposed to have been avoided by Aristotle, between the manner of being of particulars and the manner of being of universals. God's essence is, one must suppose, of the nature of universals, while his existence is not. It is not easy to state this difficulty satisfactorily, since it occurs within a logic that can no longer be accepted. But it points clearly to some kind of syntactical confusion without which much of the argumentation about God would lose its plausibility. There is little of the true philosophic spirit in Aquinas. He does not, like the Platonic Socrates, set out to follow wherever the argument may lead. He is not engaged in an inquiry, the result of which it is impossible to know in advance. Before he begins to philosophize, he already knows the truth. It is declared in the Catholic faith. If he can find apparently rational arguments for some parts of the faith, so much the better. If he cannot, he need only fall back on revelation. The finding of arguments for a conclusion given in advance is not philosophy, but special pleading. I cannot, therefore, feel that he deserves to be put on a level with the best philosophers either of Greece or of modern times. Chapter 14. Franciscan Schoolmen. Franciscans, on the whole, were less impeccably orthodox than Dominicans. Between the two orders there was keen rivalry, and the Franciscans were not inclined to accept the authority of St. Thomas. The three most important of Franciscan philosophers were Roger Bacon, Duns Scotus, and William of Ockham. St. Bonaventura and Matthew of Aquisparta also call for notice. Roger Bacon, circa 1214 to circa 1294, was not greatly admired in his own day, but in modern times has been praised far beyond his deserts. He was not so much a philosopher, in the narrow sense, as a man of universal learning with a passion for mathematics and science. Science in his day was mixed up with alchemy, and thought to be mixed up with black magic. Bacon was constantly getting into trouble through being suspected of heresy and magic. In 1257, St. Bonaventura, the general of the Franciscan order, placed him under surveillance in Paris and forbade him to publish. Nevertheless, while this prohibition was still in force, the papal legate in England, Guy de Fulk, commanded him, contrary orders notwithstanding, to write out his philosophy for the benefit of the Pope. He therefore produced in a very short time three books, Opus Majus, Opus Minus, and Opus Tertium. These seem to have produced a good impression, and in 1268 he was allowed to return to Oxford, from which he had been removed to a sort of imprisonment in Paris. However, nothing could teach him caution. He made a practice of contemptuous criticism of all the most learned of his contemporaries. In particular, he maintained that the translators from Greek and Arabic were grossly incompetent. In 1271 he wrote a book called Compendium Studii Philosophiae, in which he attacked clerical ignorance. This did nothing to add to his popularity among his colleagues, and in 1278 his books were condemned by the general of the order, and he was put in prison for 14 years. In 1292 he was liberated, but died not long afterwards. He was encyclopedic in his learning, but not systematic. Unlike most philosophers of the time, he valued experiment highly, and illustrated its importance by the theory of the rainbow. He wrote well on geography. Columbus read this part of his work and was influenced by it. He was a good mathematician. He quotes the sixth and ninth books of Euclid. He treated of perspective, following Arabic sources. Logic he thought a useless study. Alchemy, on the other hand, he valued enough to write on it. To give an idea of his scope and method, I will summarize some parts of the Opus Majus. There are, he says, four causes of ignorance. First, the example of frail and unsuitable authority. The work being written for the Pope, he is careful to say that this does not include the Church. Second, the influence of custom. Third, the opinion of the unlearned crowd. This, one gathers, includes all his contemporaries except himself. Fourth, the concealment of one's ignorance in a display of apparent wisdom. From these four plagues, of which the fourth is the worst, spring all human evils. In supporting an opinion, it is a mistake to argue from the wisdom of our ancestors, or from custom, or from common belief. In support of his view, he quotes Seneca, Cicero, Avicenna, of Veroes, Adelard of Bath, St. Jerome, and St. John Chrysostom. These authorities, he seems to think, suffice to prove that one should not respect authority. His respect for Aristotle is great, but not unbounded. Only Aristotle, together with his followers, has been called philosopher in the judgment of all wise men. Like almost all his contemporaries, he uses the designation the philosopher when he speaks of Aristotle. But even the Stagirite, we are told, did not come to the limit of human wisdom. After him, Avicenna was the prince and leader of philosophy, though he did not fully understand the rainbow because he did not recognize its final cause, which, according to Genesis, is the dissipation of aqueous vapor. Nevertheless, when Bacon comes to treat of the rainbow, he quotes Avicenna with great admiration. Every now and then he says something that has a flavor of orthodoxy, such as that the only perfect wisdom is in the scriptures, as explained by canon law and philosophy. But he sounds more sincere when he says that there is no objection to getting knowledge from the heathen. In addition to Avicenna and Averroes, he quotes Al-Farabi, follower of Kindi, died 950, very often, and Al-Bumazar, astronomer, 805 to 885, and others from time to time. Al-Bumazar is quoted to prove that mathematics was known before the flood and by Noah and his sons. This, I suppose, is a sample of what we may learn from infidels. Bacon praises mathematics as the sole, unrevealed source of certitude and as needed for astronomy and astrology. Bacon follows Averroes in holding that the active intellect is a substance separated from the soul in essence. He quotes various eminent divines, among them Grosseteste, Bishop of Lincoln, as also supporting this opinion, which is contrary to that of St. Thomas. Apparently, contrary passages in Aristotle, he says, are due to mistranslation. He does not quote Plato at first hand, but at second hand through Cicero, or at third hand through the Arabs on Porphyry. Not that he has much respect for Porphyry, whose doctrine on universals he calls childish. In modern times, Bacon has been praised because he valued experiment as a source of knowledge more than argument. Certainly his interests and his way of dealing with subjects are very different from those of the typical scholastics. His encyclopedic tendencies are like those of the Arabic writers, who evidently influenced him more profoundly than they did most other Christian philosophers. They, like him, were interested in science and believed in magic and astrology, whereas Christians thought magic wicked and astrology a delusion. He is astonishing because he differs so widely from other medieval Christian philosophers. But he had little influence in his own time, and was not, to my mind, so scientific as is sometimes thought. English writers used to say that he invented gunpowder, but this, of course, is untrue. St. Bonaventura, 1221-1274, who, as general of the Franciscan order, forbade Bacon to publish, was a man of a totally different kind. He belonged to the tradition of St. Anselm, whose ontological argument he upheld. He saw in the new Aristotelianism a fundamental opposition to Christianity. He believed in Platonic ideas, which, however, only God knows perfectly. In his writings, Augustine is quoted constantly, but one finds no quotations from Arabs and few from pagan antiquity. Matthew of Aquisparta, circa 1235-1302, was a follower of Bonaventura, but less untouched by the new philosophy. He was a Franciscan and became a cardinal. He opposed St. Thomas from an Augustinian point of view, but to him, Aristotle has become the philosopher. He is quoted constantly. Avicenna is frequently mentioned. St. Anselm is quoted with respect, as is the Pseudo-Dionysius, but the chief authority is St. Augustine. We must, he says, find a middle way between Plato and Aristotle. Plato's ideas are utterly erroneous. They establish wisdom, but not knowledge. On the other hand, Aristotle is also wrong. He establishes knowledge, but not wisdom. Our knowledge, so it is concluded, is caused by both lower and higher things, by external objects and ideal reasons. Duns Scotus, circa 1270-1308, carried on the Franciscan controversy with Aquinas. He was born in Scotland or Ulster, became a Franciscan at Oxford, and spent his later years at Paris. Against St. Thomas, he defended the Immaculate Conception, and in this, the University of Paris, and ultimately the whole Catholic Church, agreed with him. He is Augustinian, but in a less extreme form than Bonaventura or even Matthew of Acquasparta. His differences from St. Thomas, like theirs, come of a larger admixture of Platonism via Augustine in his philosophy. He discusses, for example, the question whether any sure and pure truth can be known naturally by the understanding of the wayfarer without the special illumination of the uncreated light, and he argues that it cannot. He supports this view in his opening argument solely by quotations from St. Augustine. The only difficulty he finds is Romans chapter 1, verse 20. The invisible things of God, understood by means of those things that have been made, are clearly comprehended from the creation of the world. Duns Scotus was a moderate realist. He believed in free will and had leanings towards Pelagianism. He held that being is no different from essence. He was mainly interested in evidence, that is, the kinds of things that can be known without proof. Of these, there are three kinds. 1. Principles known by themselves. 2. Things known by experience. 3. Our own actions. But without divine illumination, we can know nothing. Most Franciscans followed Duns Scotus rather than Aquinas. Duns Scotus held that since there is no difference between being and essence, the principle of individuation, that is, that which makes one thing not identical with another, must be form, not matter. The principle of individuation was one of the important problems of the scholastic philosophy. In various forms, it has remained a problem to the present day. Without reference to any particular author, we may perhaps state the problem as follows. Among the properties of individual things, some are essential, others accidental. The accidental properties of a thing are those it can lose without losing its identity, such as wearing a hat if you are a man. The question now arises, given two individual things belonging to the same species, do they always differ in essence, or is it possible for the essence to be exactly the same in both? St. Thomas holds the latter view as regards material substances, the former as regards those that are immaterial. Duns Scotus holds that there are always differences of essence between two different individual things. The view of St. Thomas depends upon the theory that pure matter consists of undifferentiated parts, which are distinguished solely by difference of position in space. Thus, a person consisting of mind and body may differ physically from another person solely by the spatial position of his body. This might happen with identical twins, theoretically. Duns Scotus, on the other hand, holds that if things are distinct, they must be distinguished by some qualitative difference. This view clearly is nearer to Platonism than is that of St. Thomas. Various stages have to be traversed before we can state this problem in modern terms. The first step, which was taken by Leibniz, was to get rid of the distinction between essential and accidental properties, which, like many that the scholastics took over from Aristotle, turns out to be unreal as soon as we attempt to state it carefully. We thus have, instead of essence, all the propositions that are true of the thing in question. In general, however, spatial and temporal position would still be excluded. Leibniz contends that it is impossible for two things to be exactly alike in this sense. This is his principle of the identity of indiscernibles. This principle was criticized by physicists, who maintained that two particles of matter might differ solely as regards position in space and time, a view which has been rendered more difficult by relativity, which reduces space and time to relations. A further step is required in modernizing the problem, and that is to get rid of the conception of substance. When this is done, a thing has to be a bundle of qualities, since there is no longer any kernel of pure thinghood. It would seem to follow that, if substance is rejected, we must take a view more akin to that of Scotus than to that of Aquinas. This, however, involves much difficulty in connection with space and time. I have treated the question as I see it under the heading Proper Names in my Inquiry into Meaning and Truth. William of Ockham is, after St. Thomas, the most important schoolman. The circumstances of his life are very imperfectly known. He was born probably between 1290 and 1300. He died on April 10th, but whether in 1349 or 1350 is uncertain. The Black Death was raging in 1349, so that this is perhaps the more probable year. Most people say he was born at Ockham in Surrey, but De Lisle Burns prefers Ockham in Yorkshire. He was at Oxford and then at Paris, where he was first the pupil and afterwards the rival of Duns Scotus. He was involved in the quarrel of the Franciscan order with Pope John XXII on the subject of poverty. The Pope had persecuted the spirituals with the support of Michael Cesena, general of the order, but there had been an arrangement by which property left to the friars was given by them to the Pope, who allowed them the benefit of it without the sin of ownership. This was ended by John XXII, who said they should accept outright ownership. At this, a majority of the order, headed by Michael of Cesena, rebelled. Ockham, who had been summoned to Avignon by the Pope to answer charges of heresy as to transubstantiation, sided with Michael of Cesena, as did another important man, Marsilio of Padua. All three were excommunicated in 1328, but escaped from Avignon and took refuge with the Emperor Louis. Louis was one of the two claimants to the empire. He was the one favoured by Germany, but the other was favoured by the Pope. The Pope excommunicated Louis, who appealed against him to the General Council. The Pope himself was accused of heresy. It is said that Ockham, on meeting the Emperor, said, "Do you defend me with a sword, and I will defend you with a pen." At any rate, he and Marsilio of Padua settled in Munich under the protection of the Emperor, and there wrote political treatises of considerable importance. What happened to Ockham after the Emperor's death in 1338 is uncertain. Some say he was reconciled to the Church, but this seems to be false. The Empire was no longer what it had been in the Hohenstaufen era, and the papacy, though its pretensions had grown continually greater, did not command the same reverence as formerly. Boniface VIII had moved it to Avignon at the beginning of the 14th century, and the Pope had become a political subordinate of the King of France. The Empire had sunk even more. It could no longer claim even the most shadowy kind of universal dominion because of the strength of France and England. On the other hand, the Pope, by subservience to the King of France, also weakened his claim to universality in temporal matters. Thus, the conflict between Pope and Emperor was really a conflict between France and Germany. England, under Edward III, was at war with France, and therefore in alliance with Germany. This caused England also to be anti-papal. The Pope's enemies demanded a general council, the only ecclesiastical authority which could be regarded as superior to the Pope. The character of the opposition to the Pope changed at this time. Instead of being merely in favour of the Emperor, it acquired a democratic tone, particularly in matters of church government. This gave it a new strength, which ultimately led to the Reformation. Dante, 1265 to 1321, though as a poet he was a great innovator, was as a thinker somewhat behind the times. His book, De Monarchia, is Ghibelline in outlook and would have been more timely 100 years earlier. He regards emperor and pope as independent and both divinely appointed. In the Divine Comedy, his Satan has three mouths, in which he eternally chews Judas Iscariot, Brutus, and Cassius, who are all three equally traitors, the first against Christ, the other two against Caesar. Dante's thought is interesting, not only in itself, but as that of a layman, but it was not influential and was hopelessly out of date. Marsilio of Padua, 1270 to 1342, on the contrary, inaugurated the new form of opposition to the Pope, in which the Emperor has mainly a role of decorative dignity. He was a close friend of William of Ockham, whose political opinions he influenced. Politically, he is more important than Ockham. He holds that the legislator is the majority of the people, and that the majority has the right to punish princes. He applies popular sovereignty also to the Church, and he includes the laity. There are to be local councils of the people, including the laity, who are to elect representatives to general councils. The general council alone should have power to excommunicate and to give authoritative interpretations of Scripture. Thus, all believers will have a voice in deciding doctrine. The Church is to have no secular authority, there is to be no excommunication without civil concurrence, and the Pope is to have no special powers. Ockham did not go quite so far as Marsilio, but he worked out a completely democratic method of electing the General Council. The conciliar movement came to a head in the early 15th century, when it was needed to heal the Great Schism. But having accomplished this task, it subsided. Its standpoint, as may be seen already in Marsilio, was different from that afterwards adopted, in theory, by the Protestants. the Protestants claimed the right of private judgment and were not willing to submit to a general council. They held that religious belief is not a matter to be decided by any governmental machinery. Marsilio, on the contrary, still aims at preserving the unity of the Catholic faith, but wishes this to be done by democratic means, not by the papal absolutism. In practice, most Protestants, when they acquired the government, merely substituted the king for the pope, and thus secured neither liberty of private judgment nor a democratic method of deciding doctrinal questions. But in their opposition to the pope, they found support in the doctrines of the conciliar movement. Of all the schoolmen, Ockham was the one whom Luther preferred. It must be said that a considerable section of Protestants held to the doctrine of private judgment even where the state was Protestant. This was the chief point of difference between Independents and Presbyterians in the English Civil War. Ockham's political works are written in the style of philosophic disputations, with arguments for and against various theses, sometimes not reaching any conclusion. We are accustomed to a more forthright kind of political propaganda, but in his day the form he chose was probably effective. A few samples will illustrate his method and outlook. There is a long treatise called 8 Questions Concerning the Power of the Pope. The first question is whether one man can rightfully be supreme both in church and state. The second is secular authority derived immediately from God or not. Third, has the Pope the right to grant secular jurisdiction to the emperor and other princes? Fourth, does election by the electors give full powers to the German king? Fifth and sixth, what rights does the church acquire through the right of bishops to anoint kings? Seventh, is a coronation ceremony valid if performed by the wrong archbishop? Eighth, does election by the electors give the German king the title of emperor? All these were at the time burning questions of practical politics. Another treatise is on the question whether a prince can obtain the goods of the church without the pope's permission. This is concerned to justify Edward III in taxing the clergy for his war with France. It will be remembered that Edward was an ally of the emperor. Then comes a consultation on a matrimonial cause, on the question whether the emperor was justified in marrying his cousin. It will be seen that Ockham did his best to deserve the protection of the emperor's sword. It is time now to turn to Ockham's purely philosophical doctrines. On this subject there is a very good book, The Logic of William of Ockham by Ernest E. Moody. Much of what I shall have to say is based on this book, which takes a somewhat unusual view, but I think a correct one. There is a tendency in writers on history of philosophy to interpret men in the light of their successors, but this is generally a mistake. Ockham has been regarded as bringing about the breakdown of scholasticism, as a precursor of Descartes or Kant or whoever might be the particular commentator's favorite among modern philosophers. According to Moody, with whom I agree, all this is a mistake. Ockham, he holds, was mainly concerned to restore a pure Aristotle, freed from both Augustinian and Arabic influences. This had also been, to a considerable extent, the aim of St. Thomas. But the Franciscans, as we have seen, had continued to follow St. Augustine much more closely than he did. The interpretation of Ockham by modern historians, according to Moody, has been vitiated by the desire to find a gradual transition from scholastic to modern philosophy. This has caused people to read modern doctrines into him when in fact he is only interpreting Aristotle. Ockham is best known for a maxim which is not to be found in his works, but has acquired the name of Ockham's razor. This maxim says, "Entities are not to be multiplied without necessity." Although he did not say this, he said something which has much the same effect, namely, "It is vain to do with more what can be done with fewer." That is to say, if everything in some science can be interpreted without assuming this or that hypothetical entity, there is no ground for assuming it. I have myself found this a most fruitful principle in logical analysis. In logic, though apparently not in metaphysics, Ockham was a nominalist. The nominalists of the 15th century, for example, Swineshead, Heytesbury, Gerson, and Dailly, looked upon him as the founder of their school. He thought that Aristotle had been misinterpreted by the Scotists, and that this misinterpretation was due partly to the influence of Augustine, partly to Avicenna, but partly to an earlier cause, Porphyry's treatise on Aristotle's categories. Porphyry, in this treatise, raised 3 questions. 1. are genera and species substances? 2. Are they corporeal or incorporeal? 3. If the latter, are they in sensible things or separated from them? He raised these questions as relevant to Aristotle's categories, and thus led the Middle Ages to interpret the Organon too metaphysically. Aquinas had attempted to undo this error, but it had been reintroduced by Duns Scotus. The result had been that logic and theory of knowledge had become dependent on metaphysics and theology. Occam set to work to separate them again. For Occam, logic is an instrument for the philosophy of nature, which can be independent of metaphysics. Logic is the analysis of discursive science. Science is about things, but logic is not. Things are individual, but among terms there are universals. Logic treats of universals, while science uses them without discussing them. Logic is concerned with terms or concepts, not as physical states, but as having meaning. Man is a species is not a proposition of logic because it requires a knowledge of man. Logic deals with things fabricated by the mind within itself, which cannot exist except through the existence of reason. A concept is a natural sign. A word is a conventional sign. We must distinguish when we are speaking of the word as a thing and when we are using it as having meaning. Otherwise, we may fall into fallacies such as man is a species, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is a species. Terms which point at things are called terms of first intention. Terms which point at terms are called terms of second intention. The terms in science are of first intention, in logic of second. Metaphysical terms are peculiar in that they signify both things signified by words of first intention and things signified by words of second intention. There are exactly 6 metaphysical terms: being, thing, something, one, true, good. Footnote. I do not here pause to criticize the use to which Occam puts these terms. End of footnote. These terms have the peculiarity that they can all be predicated of each other, but logic can be pursued independently of them. Understanding is of things, not of forms produced by the mind. These are not what is understood, but that by which things are understood. Universals in logic are only terms or concepts predicable of many other terms or concepts. Universal, genus, species are terms of second intention and therefore cannot mean things. But since one and being are convertible, if a universal existed, it would be one and an individual thing.